Because at least somebody should be able to make use of Kendall Waston's headers. It's been so... It's...
That's gotta be one of the shortest ones.
Because at least... Because at least someone has to make use of Kendall Waston's headers. It's That's So MLS, a North American soccer podcast with myself, Andrew Bates, and Nick Thornton.
Hello.
It's been International Week.
Yes.
How did you spend your International Week?
Sorry, what was that question?
How did you spend your International Week?
Oh.
Internationally?
My International Week, waiting patiently for the three MLS games and paying almost no attention to the international break. I think I just haven't been following it, so I'm a little bit out of the loop as to what the big games were. But of course, the major talking point that I saw was the Spanish language version of Kendall Waston's last minute header against Honduras to send Costa Rica through to Russia in 2020.
El Mundial, the commentator yelled. As somebody from Honduras, like, kicked a seat out on the bench.
Yeah, he was not happy. Number five. Which is weird, because at least looking at the table, it looked like Honduras had no mathematical possibility of going through anyway. So I wasn't quite sure where the... Not that Honduras is known as a team that particularly well controls its temperature in its players, but... Just the emotion of it. I don't know. I didn't think Honduras had a chance of making it to the World Cup.
If I remember, there was some chance of, like, if the U.S. fucked up enough, I thought that maybe it could make the playoff. But I don't honestly remember.
I mean, it must have meant something. But yeah, it was pretty incredible to see the big man. The celebration was better than the goal, I think. I mean, it was a great goal, but you could see what it meant to not just Kendall, but the fans and the rest of the team. That's a good team celebration. It's as good as I've seen in a while.
It's good. It's good for the Vancouver Whitecaps, I think, to have a player take such a key role on MLSsoccer.com. The league website was certainly promoting it as I think one of the key MLS players to be making a difference, at least on this particular week.
Yeah, absolutely. And while Kendall was doing his business in, I don't know where the game was played, actually. Was it in Costa Rica?
I believe it was in Costa Rica because those stands were not the stands of a
Honduran. Yeah, there seemed to be an awful lot of traveling Costa Rica fans. Mm-hmm.
And that made it a 1-1 draw, right? I'm trying to remember my,
Yes, it did. Yeah.
Hmm. Which provided the necessary points to finish second.
So, looking over to MLS a little bit here, we had three games, and everybody else had the bye week. But, there's still some interesting things to have happened around the league. We had Dallas and Colorado play each other, Sporting Kansas City and Minnesota, and then Vancouver and the New York Red Bulls.
You're missing a game, which was the most buck wild game.
Which game am I missing?
At least... You're missing Atlanta, Minnesota.
Oh, right. The midweek one.
Yes.
Right.
That one was off the... That one had a very slow build-up to the point of, like, 0-0 at halftime. Nothing much happened. And I'm pulling up the box score now, but if I recall, it was around the, the 76th minute that things... Oh, so it was Minnesota scored... to make it 1-0, and then you had goals, Atlanta goals on 67 and 72, and then Minnesota goals on 90 and 90 plus 6.
Yes.
With Atlanta getting a red card.
Well, how else are you going to finish a match like that? I'm just bringing it up again. I was so focused on rewatching the Minnesota game today, I forgot all about that one. Because somebody threw something at the ref. There was a bit of everything in this game.
Yeah, that's right. Somebody threw a bottle of water, I think, that bounced off the side of the referee. Atlanta fans proving to be, if not unruly, certainly not ruly.
Yes. Well, and... oh, right, because I remember... Yeah, right. This is the one where they had the goalkeeper sent off fairly early on, which was the right call. I know Atlanta fans weren't happy about it, but, I mean, it's unfortunate to see a team like Atlanta and fans rally around the team so well, and then just to see both the fans and the team lose their head in what was... You know, it was an emotional game, but I felt like the referee did a good job, and, you know, you have to make some tough calls sometimes, but when your goalkeeper comes out and takes out the feet of somebody who's about to score, that's got to be a red card, and you can't lose your head over that. I mean, I get it. We're all passionate fans, but it was to me, that sort of overshadowed what was otherwise a good game, and I thought Atlanta played well, but they just couldn't control themselves, and as we've seen a number of teams doing towards the home stretch here, really failing to control their players and ending up having sendings off that just really didn't need to happen.
To even up and then take the lead while at 10 men and then conceded in injury time is very disappointing, I think, for Atlanta, especially against a team like Minnesota.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because something that I'd sort of put down as a note about Minnesota, knowing that they also had the game on Saturday against Sporting KC, is that Minnesota has certainly kind of come into their own in terms of being a little bit more, showing a little bit more grit and a little bit more fight and having a lot more going forward. I think early on in the season, we saw the first 4 or 5 months where they just really sat back and seemed to invite everything that they got. And it wasn't that they couldn't break and get chances, but they looked much more positive going forward. And we saw that in Atlanta. I mean, I don't think anybody had them pegged to take that game. And it really was just through sheer perseverance, you know, a bit of luck as well, that they were able to break down and win that one last minute. Mm-hmm. And then coming into the game against Sporting Kansas City, similar thing. Nobody's expecting them to really get much out of that game, and I think Minnesota's probably ultimately disappointed they didn't get the win there.
Well, I think you've got to say that, especially given that the match with Vancouver was so lopsided in terms of opportunities for Sporting Kansas City in the last week, to be in a situation... I was just really tuning into that, the KC game, for its final couple of minutes. Mm-hmm. But they, again, were throwing everything at the wall, and they couldn't do it. They got 7 minutes of injury time. They conceded just before 90 minutes,
yeah,
while leading 1-0. They had 7 minutes of injury time in which to try and take the game back. And Minnesota got a red card in that injury time.
Yeah.
So they were really, everything was on their foot. And there was some wonderful opportunities, including one cross through the box on the floor, past, like, behind basically every defender that just couldn't find a foot.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of been the story a little bit for Minnesota this year, is it just hasn't quite happened for them, and they've connected very well, but, you know...
Other way around, I'm talking about Kansas City.
Oh, I see,
the
okay.
One that, well, that had it on their boot.
Right. Well, and in that sense, too, I'd say, so, that, like, I'm consistently amazed at how high SKC presses in a game, but they're set up in such a way that they just suffocate teams. Like, it's very, very hard to find any way through them. But what seems to have been working well for them all season has sort of started to falter a little bit. And that, I think, would be causing some concern for Sporting Kansas City going into the playoffs, although they haven't yet secured a spot. One imagines that they will. But the fact that they're not able to generate a ton going forward, for all that possession, for all that brilliant on-field setup, they seem to really be lacking in chances lately, or putting those chances away. And when you see a player like Latif Blessing running around just owning the pitch and cutting through defenses like butter, it's unfortunate that you're not seeing actually much more production from him. I mean, he's been a bright spot for them all season. I thought Diego Rubio's goal was fantastic, to just sort of dribble through the defenders, and he didn't have much on, but just buried it high and at such short range, there's nothing any goalkeeper can do about it. But Yeah, it's weird. They're still a fantastically well set up team, but I don't know what you think of their chances or where they might actually end up, considering that they really seem to be struggling, and struggling against teams that have had some late luck in coming into form in Vancouver and Minnesota. But you still think that a Sporting KC of a few months ago probably could have put either of those teams away quite easily, and yet just seem to struggle to actually make something of their great setup. But I don't know. What do you think about that?
When you are in the position of choking the life out of teams, as KC have done a lot this season, especially early on. One of our first podcasts, we were just surprised at how few goals they had been able to concede. Mm-hmm. That's all well and good. And they do have players like Gerso are great from a scoring perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But when... If you can't... They were also if I recall, and still are, a leader in draws.
Yes.
And the problem that I've mentioned with that before is that if you can't put away games, it doesn't matter how good your defense is. And the fact that some of these disappointing results in the last 2 weeks are 1-0, 1-1,
mm-hmm.
right? Like it's good to be able to hold your opponents low, like especially, I guess, you know, the Whitecaps are as much as Whitecaps fans always sort of have healthy skepticism.
Mm-hmm.
The Whitecaps are first in the West, and there's always danger, as we've been proving with Minnesota. Holding down to one goal is not bad, but if you can't make offense to deal with to accompany that, it doesn't matter.
Especially heading into the playoffs, and that's kind of, I think, the big question mark heading over them right now. We know their defensive record, and yeah, it's slipped as of late, and now the worrying thing too is Melia is out with a hamstring injury. He was subbed off, I believe, in the around the 59th minute or so, or maybe a little bit earlier than that, with a hamstring problem. I haven't been able to find anything about whether that's just a bit of cramp or if it's something more serious.
Mm.
But, you know, obviously he's been a real key piece for them, but they just seem to be faltering a little bit. And, you know, in MLS, I don't think it's a mark of a bad team to be giving up one or even two goals in a game. But for a team that's really battened down the hatches for most of the season, but as you said, hasn't been able to score a ton of goals either, in the playoff picture, I actually sort of put them as a bit of an underdog, making it in, not making it in, but progressing through it, because they haven't been able to score that many goals. And the teams that they're facing are, you know, now they have a whole season of knowing what KC is about, which is that they set themselves up and they defend, and they're very patient in going forward. But so patient, in fact, in this game, that was my other sort of note, is they snuff out their own attack because they've got these great triangles set up, but they're passing back so often that you allow the other team a ton of time to reset and set themselves up. And I think Minnesota, when they got the goal, you sort of saw that come into play, is that for all the positive possession that Sporting has, and they're kicking the ball around at will, they sort of have this build-up, and then all of a sudden the ball's going back to their center back at the halfway line. And you just see Minnesota literally reset the two lines of defenders, and you've got to start the play all over again and just wait for that perfect pass through. In a playoff picture, I think that's a really hard system to win with, especially if it's over two legs, which it very well could be for Sporting KC.
Mm-hmm. You've got to think, even if you are theoretically underdogs against Kansas City, that as the Whitecaps did, you can hold them off, you could smother their attack as they try to smother yours, and then try to either get something on the counter late in the game or wait for the shootout.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if Melia is out.
Yeah, I think that will be the really big question for them is if Melia is out for even a couple of weeks, what is that going to mean for their hopes? The remarkable thing is, and I don't want to get too carried away with the standings, because of course in the West, things have not changed much, even though the East is now cemented. We know who's in the playoffs and who's not. In the West, the Vancouver Whitecaps are still the only team to have clinched a playoff spot. KC is still sitting in second place, but with 48 points, and I believe now no points out of their last two, if Portland and Seattle can get some results next weekend, the picture could change quite a bit. And again, without Melia, that makes an interesting and slightly worrisome scenario for this team that's been absolutely rock solid in defense. I mean, they're in second place with 25 goals allowed. Vancouver Whitecaps are in first with 46 goals allowed. The difference there being is that Kansas has only scored 38 goals this season, which is third worst in the West behind San Jose and Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
Now, goals aren't everything, but they sure do help. And as we've seen in the playoffs, if you know, obviously a draw is not going to cut it. And I think KC has kind of been used to that, of just sitting down, battening down the hatches and getting the points to get themselves to where they are. But in a playoff scenario, I think that they've got to look at a slightly different tactic and be a little bit more adventurous going forward and try to get their forwards on the ball faster than they have been doing.
I think it's a sign of what the teams are like in each conference and what the situation is.
Mm-hmm.
That no playoff team in the East has any less than has any fewer than 50 goals for, and in the West only Portland and Houston do.
Yeah,
have a tally over that mark. So it's been a lot tighter and a lot more cagey, I think, in the Western Conference.
Absolutely. Okay, so I don't think there's much to talk about in this one, but the Dallas-Colorado match, one that potentially could have meant a lot to Dallas or meant slightly less but something to Colorado, who's been slowly sort of waking up, although it means nothing at this point, really. But what did you think of this match?
I caught a little bit of it to the end. I didn't really see anything while I was watching that caught my eye. But I think that what you really have to look at is how uninspired. We talked a little bit about this week in terms of teams that are in the playoff hunt not really being able to actually be that inspiring.
Yeah.
In their final push, and this is a scenario where unlike in the East, anyone. It's still wide open. You could still definitely biff it just as hard. And I do think that it's they are extremely lucky. FC Dallas is. I know I just biffed my plural or not team thing. But FC Dallas is extremely lucky to have escaped with a fine from the Barrios Tesho Ekandele substitute incident from the Orlando game.
Yeah,
$75,000 of general allocation money and $25,000 of real money.
Yeah, of actual, real physical money, and to not lose that point. I mean, yeah, I think probably some are feeling a little bit hard done by about that, but fair play. I mean, the only thing I really had to say about that game is that Jesse Gonzalez, the Dallas goalkeeper, who. We haven't heard much about this season, really. In fact, we haven't heard much about anybody on Dallas because they just really haven't been able to string much of any kind of results together. Comes up with two massive saves that just, you know, you could see there's been talk about how highly sought after he is, and that game was a good example of it. You know, ends with a 1-1 result. It wasn't a beautiful game by any stretch. Colorado is certainly putting in some fight, and players are playing for their positions now and for their contracts, but you just really do expect something a little bit better from Dallas, and I think, like many people, kind of find myself scratching my head to figure, like, what exactly has changed, and how come Dallas just hasn't been able to put some of these games away this season? Again, the Colorado game, is one that I feel like they should have won, but they just never seem to have that much in it. And, you know, I think on one of the plays that was one of the better defensive efforts from Dallas, the best defender back is Ruti, who's winning the ball and essentially playing as a right back. Now, if a team is having to rely on your star striker, which you want them to be back and defending on those set pieces, I still think if that's the major defensive note of positivity is that Uruti was able to steal away a ball and clear it out of the box, then, yeah, I think that they may just creep into the playoffs, but I don't think anybody's really liking their chances of making it very far, especially if Real Salt Lake is able to put together some results, depending on what happens next week with Vancouver and San Jose. San Jose is at 42 points, a big win puts them at 45, and they could actually take away that last spot from Dallas.
In general, you don't expect, you expect your right backs to be getting forward and getting getting offense.
Yes.
You do generally not expect your strikers to be playing right back.
No, and it's very positive. Shout out to Rudy for doing his defensive effort, but it seemed like all too often that was kind of the case for Dallas, is that they, in order to get any kind of result, have to defend as a team, which is what a coach wants in some sense, but just so little going forward. And this slick, speedy Dallas team of yore seems to be a thing of the past, and they just can't seem to really generate that much. And I hardly think of Colorado, despite their recent run of form, as being a team that really suffocates and stifles their opposition.
You have for Dallas gets kind of splits their schedule strength in terms of playing Seattle, but then LA in the final game. Houston has to play SKC twice, and then KC also plays Salt Lake. So all of Sporting Kansas City's remaining games are against fellow Western Conference playoff teams that are in the thick of it, which is not a position I think you would love to be in if you're Sporting Kansas City.
No, and I think it speaks volumes to the sort of untold story of the Whitecaps. I mean, the one people are talking about now is it was really positive of them to clinch so early on, because we're looking now at a very volatile West, even more than before, where depending on the next, you know, the results are going to change everything from week to week. I would imagine we're going to see a number of draws. I think there's enough pressure on teams, players away on international duty and injuries, that I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of shifting around in the table. I think where we might see shifting is in that sixth and final spot. I think it's Real Salt Lake's to win, and it's FC Dallas's to lose. At this point, based on Dallas's performances, I don't like their chances, and I figure like RSL has a little bit more of the wind beneath them at the moment and could take that final spot.
I think before we've discussed San Jose as a possibility, but I do think that RSL is in there as well. It's a big question. One thing that I always think, moving on to the last game on the schedule for the MLS.
Do we have to?
is that I always look at it whenever you have a team on a slump. The last thing you want is the next team to face the slumping team is for them to get truly embarrassed.
Yeah.
And while I don't, the 4-2 loss to Toronto was not the worst for the worst possible result that you can have as the New York Red Bull at Red Bulls, it's not ideal to give up the supporter shield and to be the B side of that game. And we talked about them being not that impressive, and they certainly brought it in this game when they beat the Whitecaps 3-0.
They sure did. At the very start of the game, so Robinson played a very different formation than he has. I think he's only used it once or twice this season, with the 3-5-2, having Tim Parker, Marcel DeJong, and Aaron Mond at the back, and Nerwinski and Harvey out on the wings playing as this sort of pseudo-fullback, half-winger kind of thing. Which really just seemed to result, long story short, is nobody seemed to know where they needed to be. And even though they lined up exactly with the formation that the New York Red Bulls use, it's clear they haven't practiced this much, and I think it was a huge tactical error on Robinson's part. I mean, he rolled the dice and decided to try to match up man for man in the same formation, but it did not work. And, you know, Tim Parker, I think, has had a great season overall and has definitely grown as a player, certainly grown after a bit of a slump last year. But, I mean, it was on every single goal from New York. The defense was just really nowhere to be seen and really trying to run back and get after it. And Aaron Mond and Jacob Nowinski just seemed to totally have their wires crossed about who was covering who. And when you've got Bradley Wright Phillips steaming down that wing, you need some communication there. You need to know whose responsibility it is to be marking him. And it just seemed all too easy for the Red Bulls. And I think the sad thing is that considering the pressure and the number of times they were caught out of position, I think they were lucky to escape 3-0.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a situation where you kind of felt like the fight went out at 2-0, if not a little before that.
Definitely. They've had a congested schedule for sure. We know they're missing Waston as well as Bolaños and Reyna, so I'd say in Waston and Reyna, two of their key players. I think had Waston been there, we probably would have seen the traditional four at the back instead of the three. But I wanted to ask you this, because I don't think there's too much that we can take out of this game except for the fact that the New York Red Bulls put together a very solid performance. The Whitecaps were not used to their formation. There was a number of pretty poor performances from the Whitecaps that, at the end of the day, I think you could say this result is not that important. The Whitecaps have only lost 2 out of the last 10. They'll be playing San Jose at home. That's a game that, in theory, they should be able to win. We'll see. I imagine they won't be playing with the same 3-5-2 formation again at home.
Right.
But I wanted to ask you, there's a number of pretty poor performances that are quite troubling at this point in the season and could really affect who we end up seeing in the starting lineups in the playoffs. And I just wanted to see, for your money, who was good on the Whitecaps and who was sort of forgettable? And if you notice a trend there, and sort of if you were starting to look at a starting lineup for the playoffs, who you would be cutting from that starting 11?
Well, I can't think of anything in particular, but I can't say I've seen anything. I didn't watch the KC game, but for highlights, so I don't know if this is the 100% truth, but I didn't see anything from Marcel DeJong in defensive midfield that made me think that that was 100% a great idea, especially when you are without Kendall Waston and you've decided to give Aaron Mond a look, which at this point in the season, okay, they've now clinched. We're in the conference 50-50, so if you've got to give this guy a look at some point before you get to the playoffs, I guess this is not the worst time to do it. But when you're already using a sort of an iffy backline to have DeJong in that position, how did you think he did?
I think overall, I think he had a little bit more luck than Aaron Mond and Tim Parker did. But overall, one of the things I would say, though, is that Marcel DeJong is used to playing as a bit of an outside back. Aaron Mond, I don't believe, is, and I could be wrong on this, but Tim Parker's not used to playing that very center defensive role. And I don't quite get why you wouldn't just try keeping with the system that they know has been working for them and having Aaron Mond line up beside Timmy Parker. You put Jordan Harvey where he's comfortable. You put Jake Nowinski where he's comfortable and stick with the four. And then maybe have Marcel DeJong sit in front of them as a bit more of a sweeper to try to negate some of that attack. Because, I mean, they've just, New York Red Bulls have a ton of speed to burn. We know have excellent crisp passes. But instead of what should have been in a defensive mode, 5 at the back, it really just resulted in there being 3 or sometimes 2, because I think Marcel DeJong did end up having to go forward and act as more of a sweeper. Uh-huh. And so then you just had your 2 center backs. But because of their position, they didn't seem to know where to be. And again, Nowinski and Mond just seemed all over each other and not being able to read who was supposed to be there. And then that caused confusion for Osted, who I think had a overall not great performance. Especially that first goal from Royer. I mean, it was a great shot from a tough angle, but I felt like Osted was waiting for somebody to step two. They didn't, and just reacted really, really late. And as well as the... I know there was a ton of traffic in front of him from that last screamer of a goal from Philippe, but I don't know. For me, there's so many different pieces I could pick apart of individual performances and the team as a whole.
I think when you are... This is not a great time for Osted to stumble, because I said that I don't know about this trying to put pressure on him so close to the playoffs with Stefan Marinovic.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about this a little bit later with Montreal. I think you want players to be settled, and I hate the idea that this is what we're going to talk about every time Osted isn't the greatest keeper he could be.
Yes.
Especially when you need a little bit of togetherness.
Absolutely. And this is maybe one of those things that I don't know if you want to quite say it backfired on Rabo by bringing Marinovic in. I mean, he had to bring in a goalkeeper because Tornaghi left. So he had to do something, and it was a great signing. But there's got to be some serious questions now of the coaching staff of, is Osted fit to serve in the playoffs, considering, okay, it was one performance against OKC. We've seen only a couple of games with Stefan Marinovic, but he looks much more confident. And I'm only saying this, and I don't know if I'm reading too much into it, but having seen Osted play for a number of years, just the body language and the expression, he seemed to be out of ideas. And the David Osted that we're used to seeing charging out and barking orders and taking command of his team seemed to be all but silent. And that's kind of worrying. And you've got to think right now, Rabo and the coaching staff is asking themselves some serious questions about not just the playoffs, but the next couple of games. If they get Marinovic back in time because he's away on international duty, does he not earn that starting spot?
It's hard. I would actually say in general that you may not have needed, even though Tornaghi wanted to return to Italy, as far as I recall, mm-hmm. you may not have... needed to bring somebody back, because that game where Tornaghi was passed over for Richie,
mm-hmm.
I thought was great for Richie. And I don't know that you need to, in the short term, I don't know that you needed necessarily to bring somebody in if that meant giving more minutes to Spencer Richie, the third string keeper. But the scuttlebutt I keep hearing, and I don't have great sourcing on any of this, it's just what I... Let me pass around a base rumor that maybe Osted might want to move on to, or people might be looking around for him
mm-hmm.
in the next season. And it's absolutely right to plan ahead to life after David Osted if he's moving along. But it's rough to do it right in the middle of your playoff run.
It is. I don't think it was a bad decision on the Whitecaps' part. Unfortunately, because of the way the transfer windows work, sometimes you've just got to pounce sometimes. And I think Marinovic becoming available at a very, very good price. He's at a great age as well, and he's highly sought after. I thought it was a great signing, but it did create this kind of conundrum now. Marius Rovda put to bed the rumors that Minnesota was looking for a David Osted and allocation money trade. Apparently that's not a thing. Because there's a brief little rumor on Twitter about that, thinking Osted would follow Rovda to Minnesota, and maybe Shuttleworth would come to Vancouver or go somewhere else, and money, etc. A usual MLS transfer involving six different teams and Swiss bank accounts. But there has been talk all of this season about Osted, and, I mean, first of all, what kind of money they would need to offer him to keep him in Vancouver, to extend his contract, and his desire to... perhaps pursue something in Europe again. We know his family is settled in Vancouver and he seems happy here, but I think that Marinovic has changed the picture, and for better or for worse for Osted. But talking just based on performance, I think that there's a serious question mark over David Osted right now. not that he's been terrible, not that he's had a bad season by any stretch, but, you know, if you live and die as a team and as a squad, I just think that what the Whitecaps need right now is a little bit of a steadying of the ship and some leadership at the back. And I think Marinovic, at least from what we've seen of him so far, has proven that. And I kind of wonder, I don't know if he's back in time for Sunday's match against San Jose, but I kind of wonder, do you give him the start and say, okay, you know, if you can crank out this performance, then maybe you're in, and give him another shout before the playoffs, knowing that you've clinched, knowing that you want to secure a spot. But I felt like what we've seen of Marinovic so far is just a very, very confident young goalkeeper and one that's trying to prove himself. And if you're bringing players in to compete against your starters, David Oestead, again, just based on performance, has not risen to that pressure. And I wouldn't say he's buckled, but at some point you've got to make a decision about what's going to be best for your team. And it arguably right now is not keeping Oestead in as your starter.
I think I like Marinovic. I think he's got a good attitude. People like him. I think with two games in the season, you've got to stick with David Oestead. You've got to give him the chance to be the talisman that I think helps his performance. Mm-hmm. And you've got to... You've done the good work of giving Marinovic time to establish himself and become trusted. And I know one game is not necessarily trust,
no.
But the chance, or however much it's been, but the chance to have it not be a question mark, if it's necessary, if Oestead goes down injured, if there is a moment where the switch in the playoffs where the switch clearly needs to happen for quality of play reasons, mm-hmm. you do it. And you know that this player has had at least one good performance that can maybe make it work. But as weird as it is to have a goalkeeper where you aren't 100% sure about that the performance is merited, but you're also not sure that you can keep them, mm-hmm. In terms of being a hot property, I think that you've got to stick with your number one through the playoffs.
Sure.
Regardless. And I mean, this is an interesting player, but you've got him for a long time, or longer than this stretch of games.
Mm-hmm.
I was joking that when somebody had said that the teams were throwing accusations of tapping up against each other, in the case of Oestead in Minnesota, and I was just joking that it's Adrian Heath just sending David a copy of every article about how well Marinovic did,
yeah,
on Facebook, just like, hey, look at this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, overall, I think I agree. But how this actually shakes out will be very interesting. I would expect you're probably right, and Oestead keeps his starting spot and keeps it through the playoffs. I'm just going to say it now, and in a way I hope I'm wrong. I think Oestead is going to be leaving Vancouver in the offseason. I think he's done tremendously well, but I think he is going to be looking for other opportunities. His price is very, very high. If he's going to stay in Vancouver, they're going to have to offer him a lot more money. And now they've got the confidence in knowing Marinovic is there and a player they can work with and develop. I also think you're right about Spencer Ritchie. I think, you know, you move Oestead on, free up a ton of salary money, and you've got Stefan Marinovic, you've got Spencer Ritchie, and then you bring in a third keeper as a bit of a buffer. But as much as it kills me to say that, because David Oestead has been such a great spokesperson, face of, and strong stalwart person for the Whitecaps, I don't see many plausible scenarios short of him making a ton of penalty saves that win us the MLS Cup where he stays this season. I think that he's served really, really well, and I don't want to see him go, but I think that there's a lot of interest in him, and he's a very, very expensive keeper to keep on your roster. when you know you've got one of the hotter younger international talents waiting in the wings, it's a total waste of Marinovic to be playing four games a season or five games a season or only playing the Canadian Champions League. That's not what they brought Marinovic in for.
Mm-hmm. I think that the one thing that I noted, if this was kind of a nothing game for Vancouver, somehow the Whitecaps had the pleasure of eliminating no fewer than four teams from contention for the East's final playoff spot. And maybe I was thinking we could just go through with the one sentence about each one.
Sure.
Now that their season has come to an end, and maybe spend a little bit more time at the end.
Sure.
Orlando City.
Yes.
Has missed the boat.
Yeah, they sure have. Oh, yeah. Orlando just can't seem to quite get things sorted out. I thought they had an interesting season, right? Like, they've been able to put together results. I mean, that crazy six-goal rout that they had recently was a sign of what they can do when they click. But they need to reshape and reorganize in the offseason. I don't think anybody can say it's unfair that they've missed out. And they are perhaps one of the teams that best exemplifies the model of MLS that's shifting away from putting all of your money in big-name players and hoping that that works for you. Doesn't mean that you can't buy an aging star from Europe, but if that's going to be your only formula towards success, I think you're going to miss out on the playoffs.
Also, I had said that this was going to be a quick bite, but one of the biggest pieces of off-the-field news was that several players, not only, we were talking about this, not only have Kyle Larin and Will Johnson been engaged in some trouble with the law this season while playing for Orlando. Several Orlando players, including Giles Barnes and Orlando Pride forward Alex Morgan, were kicked out of McDonald's for getting into an altercation at a pub.
A McDonald's in Disneyland also, or Disney World, I believe.
A McDonald's? Or was it, or I heard it was a bar.
I thought it was in Disney World. They were at, like, the, what's the, you know, like, the international forum thing, the... Okay, I gotta look this up now. I'll say this quick note. I was a big fan of Giles Barnes, despite, what he was able to, not do in Vancouver, as the case was. Mm. But I think it's time to move him on, as well as a number of the other players in Orlando. I think given the interest in Europe in Kyle Larin, despite what he's been able to produce in Orlando, I see him as another point of, like, he hasn't produced, and it's just, I guess you don't want to read too much into these things, but the Epcot Center, that's what I'm thinking of. They got booted out of the Epcot Center. Like, come on. And what does that say, too, about, you know, your season has ended and you've had a poor season, and then to have all of these sort of high-profile things happening with your players off the pitch. You know, I'm sorry, in a professional league, it just doesn't fly anymore. And I think that I think Orlando will choose to pass on a lot of these players and say, you know, if you're not willing to work for the paycheck, we'll find somebody who can. And the proof is in where they ended up this season. I'm not saying that they're all ultimately connected, but I mean, you've got to have these players who are getting paid a lot of money to produce in Orlando step up and produce, and they just haven't. And if that's the way that they're gonna present themselves off the pitch, I think it's time to move on from them. The great thing too with Kyle Larin is that Orlando can make a ton of money off of selling him and find a player who can commit and actually produce a little bit more consistently, as good as Larin has been.
It doesn't seem like they were really doing anything beyond the pale in the scale of a normal person, like something that you would really be shocked at hearing your friend is doing, but it's just not a good look at the professional level.
It really isn't, and not at that pay grade. That's the thing, right? I mean, this isn't... You know, you were caught on film drunk walking down the street, but like to actually be causing problems and shouting at bartenders and and getting kicked out. I mean, it's just, this is bad headlines, right? Like, getting kicked out of the Epcot Center at Disney World. Like, come on. Go over to Kyle Aaron's apartment. Nobody's driving. Crack some beers.
No,
you know,
no.
Throw some crap off the roof if you want to, but try to do it in private. Like, it's just, it's really pretty ridiculous. And I think that, I think the club will take note, and I don't imagine those players who have been a sort of, even if it's a PR thorn in the side this year, I don't think we'll expect to see them back. And unfortunately, this seems to be the case with Giles Barnes, is a player that really showed so much promise earlier in his career, just seems to be kind of aimless. And again, really surplus for the money, unfortunately.
I think that seeing Kyle Aaron at the international level, you've got to say that I think you're right that moving him onto Europe is a good idea, because I think that when he is in a smaller fishbowl, like the Canada team, sadly, I think he can kind of be a brooding protege, or a brooding, what's the word I'm looking for a young talent of note. You know, absolutely. I think that working from underneath is good for Kyle Aaron.
Yeah.
Or would be good for Kyle Aaron.
I agree. I say, you know, send him to, you know, the English Championship League, or I know there's been a few Premier League clubs that have been interested in him. I don't know that he's quite at that level, but yeah, if you put him on the bench for Everton, he's either going to really rise to the occasion and develop into the player everybody thinks he can, and he probably can, or he's going to fail. But I think keeping players like him at Orlando, they need fresher talent that is willing to step up and actually do something with the opportunity. And it's just so disappointing to see from Kyle Aaron, despite the stuff off the field. He's just been really inconsistent this year. And as has Giles Barnes. I think these are players that it's a lot of money on the books to have guys that just don't seem to have their full heads in the game.
Prodigy was the word I was saying.
Prodigy, yes.
Philadelphia Union. Also on 39 points, eliminated.
Yeah, I feel like that was a little unfortunate. I thought they've had a bit of a late run. I think they deserve to be where they ended up, but I think they've got to rebuild and find some sort of identity. They've got a great core to the team. They've got a great coach. Are they getting a new stadium, or am I thinking of DC? I think it's DC that's getting the new stadium.
DC's getting the new stadium. The Philadelphia one, I think, is rather nice still. It's recent, I think.
Yeah, I think I'm getting the two mixed up. They've got some fantastic players, an okay season. Certainly positives, but I think the best you can say is it's hardly a surprise that they were eliminated. It'll be interesting to see what moves they make, because I don't think they'll be clearing house. I don't think they've had quite the same issues that Orlando has, and I think they could make a few key tweaks and end up as a very competitive team in the East next year.
New England, also eliminated on 39 points.
Oh, New England, New England, New England. Well, new coach, maybe some new faces, maybe a bit of a shuffle. But again, I think that's hard to argue. I mean, 58 goals allowed. That's the highest in the East, I believe. Really poor defense, really poor lack of discipline, especially in the last few months. And another team that I think they need to really... They made a couple of tweaks following last year's sort of okay campaign. I think that they need to shuffle things around a little bit more and look for some stronger playmakers that are going to be willing to make the difference. We know that they've got great forwards, and they've got speed down the wings, but in terms of depth, they've really missed it this year. And unfortunately, bringing back our old friend Gershon Kofi didn't really seem to help them out any much this season, who they missed greatly last season.
Between Gershon Kofi and a former Vancouver Whitecaps interim coach Tommy Sain, I don't know that the Whitecaps 2011 season is what they wanted to emulate. when it came to the later half of this year.
Seems to be. So the final team here that was eliminated is Montreal Impact. What are your thoughts on them?
I mentioned earlier about having players settled, and that ludicrous Piatti debacle of them waiting way too long to give him a contract, I think, was not helpful.
No.
It wasn't the only thing, but it's just that's just something that sticks out in my mind is it's silly to have been talking about that at such a key part of the season.
Yeah, it's always unfortunate, too, when you see a front-of-house offer, a back-of-house office, a front office, that's the word I'm looking for, of a team distract from the on-field performance, and I definitely think that did affect them.
I would definitely not blow the team up. There is, as I see today, reports on MLSsoccer.com, which is... It's always funny to me that the league has so many brand journalists because it seems so strange on an official source to say
to have transfer source from. It's a little bizarre.
It's like who Mauro Biello has to be asking, like, who told you?
Yeah, just Don Garber creating, just making rumors up in a room.
Right. I mean, everybody there. I know everybody there is doing good work. I know a couple people who. Who work for the league website, but it's just funny.
Yeah.
But it seems like Mauro Biello and his staff, according to this team, this report, which sources it from TSN 690, suggesting that something could change. I don't think that there too much is wrong in the lineup. I think that they're bringing some good players up, actually retaining. Piatti is a great sign for the future.
Yeah.
I think that there were some key results. They play Toronto one more time before the end of the season. Some key results did not come through for them. They did not they weren't able to get what they needed, and I think that they had the opportunity to do so.
Yeah, again, I agree. I think that, and we've talked about this before, is that Montreal's been disappointing, not because that they've been bad, but because they've been not good at really key moments. And they've seemed to have been so good and so positive for so many things. As you mentioned, their academy system is starting to churn out graduates, as you will. I think they've got a great foundation and a lot going forward that's really going to help them out. I agree. I don't think they need to clear the decks by any stretch. I think they are a team that has a bit of identity. You know, they're scrappy and they'll fight, but they're another team that's given up a lot of goals this season and a lot of bad goals. I think they really do need to look at shoring up their back line, you know, and potentially bringing in another keeper. But that's all I could say about their season is disappointing, not for what it didn't achieve, but for how much it did achieve, and then to fall short of the playoffs.
I know we wanted to talk a little bit about Toronto, but just before we do, since it's the international break,
yes,
I wanted to stuff in a mention that the NWSL playoffs had started, the Women's Pro Soccer League in North America. Canadian captain Christine Sinclair and the Portland Thorns beat Orlando Pride 4-1, which is unfortunate. It was a dominant display with Tobin Heath doing quite well. I saw that game. Tobin Heath came back from an injury and was able to stick around, I think, for a decent amount of time. So that will be good for those teams, and I think that in that semifinal, you had the two MLS-affiliated teams. In the other semifinal, you had the Chicago Red Stars, who I believe are independent but play at Toyota Park, against the North Carolina Courage. North Carolina winning 1-0. They were last year's champions when they were the Western New York Flash. There was a relocation by the Western New York Flash just because the family was not able to contribute financially at that level anymore. it's sad to see a champion relocate, but you know there was a team that wanted to buy, and that franchise, the North Carolina FC franchise, is looking to expand to the MLS.
Mm. Right. Yeah.
So it's always weird when you have a relocated champion team that is looking to repeat in the final.
Yeah. Could be some interesting airline tickets sold that night. It's sort of too bad about Orlando Pride season. I mean, I know they've squeaked in and had some results, but I thought bringing Marta in was such a incredible signing and such a positive thing for the club. And yeah, but they've yo-yoed up and down quite a bit this season too. So
they are a team, if I recall, that put a lot of resources into a couple players, and Alex Morgan is one of them. Mm-hmm. And she came back. But then chose to go to Europe, and you have to remember with the NWSL and U.S. Women's National Team players that it's all the same boss.
Yeah.
So I definitely don't look askance on a player that says I want to give Europe a shot. But it is just rough for a team to be sort of caught up in the machinations between a player and the national team.
Absolutely. I don't know. Maybe Alex Morgan is just going for a better wine selection in Europe.
Oh, but him.
Sorry, Alex. Come on, Epcot Center, come on. That is a sacred place.
Well, PSG missed the Champions League knockout rounds this year, so I guess they don't have any further use. Now, the one thing that the last thing we wanted to talk about was Toronto FC, because they are now on the verge. They sit, I think, on 65 points. The record amount of points is 68,
mm-hmm.
Which they need 4 from their last 6 to get. One game will be against Montreal, who beat them a couple weeks ago. What do you, looking back on this season so far, what do you think? And how do you think they've done? And how do you think they stand to do in the run-in?
I don't think I'm going to say anything here that's going to be too revelatory to anyone who's listened or watched anything to do with Toronto this year. They've been exceptional, and the fact that they're so close to setting this record speaks volumes about just how exceptional they've been. As we know, they have their vulnerabilities, they have their off games. However, that's also MLS. We know there's no team, we don't have a Man City or a Chelsea in MLS that's going to win every single game and maybe lose 2 in a season or rout every single team by a massive scoreline, although that latter point Toronto has done numerous times this season. Despite recent results, I think everybody does expect them to beat the record. And if they don't, I think it's going to affect their mentality going into the playoffs in a very negative way. I think that if they are able to break the record, there's absolutely no reason why they shouldn't just storm through and get the MLS Cup this season as well. Despite what I've said in the past about some of their weaknesses and the fact that they are vulnerable and they do give up goals, I think at this point, looking across both conferences, and of course it's MLS, so anything can happen, name a team that you think in the playoffs could go toe-to-toe with Toronto and knock them out. I just don't see it happening.
I think that it's kind of funny. One of the things that I asked when we were first getting started, a friend of mine that's an Impact reporter, mm-hmm. was, you know, if Montreal and Toronto met again, what do you think would happen? And we are going to get that rematch in the league, mm-hmm. Happily. They're, for some reason, them and the New England Revolution are the two teams that are not in the playoffs that, for some reason, can have their number on a good day. When you look at teams that are in, I think that if it is sort of the faded rematch of Seattle,
yeah,
unless something huge changes, I think they both rely on a similar game plan.
Mm-hmm.
Toronto is perhaps slightly less reliant on Giovinco than they were last year.
That's very true.
Just because of the addition of Victor Vasquez has center the attack a little further up in the midfield, or a little further down in the midfield.
Mm-hmm.
But we are going to have a New York, I don't think, is that interesting as an opponent for Toronto. I don't think that they have shown the ability to do much.
No.
New York City. New York Red Bulls, maybe. I mean, they were handled pretty comprehensively, but there was a point there before the second penalty in their recent game where they could have done something.
Mm-hmm.
Within the conference, Atlanta, Toronto, as the last game of the season, they're taking the tarps off the upper deck to have the full 70,000 seat capacity. That's going to be a very interesting game in terms of seeing whether or not a team can break down Toronto.
I'm just going to say it now. There's going to be at least two red cards in that game in Atlanta. I'm just going to call it right now. Certainly one of them's going to an Atlanta player. We'll see about Toronto. But, yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing is that Toronto has two very difficult games left. And although... has Atlanta been eliminated? No.
No, Atlanta is in the thick of
yeah.
it.
And in form. Yeah, we'll see. I still think the expectation is that Toronto will break that record. And if they do, again, I think that it's merely a case of them continuing to do what they've done well all season long. They've got the formula to win games and to win a championship. And as you said, I think that they could do that against every team without Giovinco, which says a lot about their chances. I don't think it'll hurt them to have Giovinco healthy and in the lineup or even available as a sub, but they've come a long, long way even from last year, which was a very, very positive season. So I don't know. I'm shifting my tune a little bit. I think that it's Toronto's year. But these last two games are going to matter a lot.
They had a really tough start with four draws, one win, one loss. That was partially, there was, I believe, an issue where Drew Moore had an irregular heartbeat.
Yeah.
And also, Greg Vanney was called away from the side due to the death of his mother.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, it was just an emotional, challenging time. And they, after sort of their first... After the one loss in that six-game run came at the end, and then for whatever reason after that, they went another eight games without a defeat, and then later on in the year, they went on another crazy run of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I think. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yes, 11.
I know.
games without a defeat.
When you read it,
even just counting it up.
I also think a team that, you know, in shifting out of just the performance part, a team that is so galvanized together in struggle, the team that lost together in the final in such a heartbreaking way in the shootout, as you mentioned, the scary things that have happened this season with Drew Moore, with Betashore, with Vanny getting called away, this is a team that is also a true team, and mm-hmm. also a team that's been criticized quite fairly in the past of having no real identity, having no character, having no resilience or chemistry. They're now the model team of a team that really does stick together and has depth. And so when a player goes down injured or gets called away, somebody else steps in, and not just to prove themselves, but really you get the feeling that they're there to do it for the team. And there's a lot of pride on the line and a lot for the team to prove, not just individual players. So the fact that TFC has unlocked that, I think, is just it doesn't just bode well for them this season in a likely route of the cup. I think it bodes well for the seasons to come, that they've now established a formula that works. They've got a great team that now they just need to be bringing up youth players through it, making a few signings here and there, but that they really don't need to change too much probably over the next 2 to 3 years.
I believe it. We were talking a little bit about it, and I pinned it in the top of my mind about how I felt. There had been the switch from Clint Irwin to Alex Bono.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think what do you think that has done? Do you think that could shift again? And what do you think it says? I think that it... I have a question of whether or not it is a symbol of the level of MLS where I don't think anywhere... I think goalkeepers are always... Good goalkeepers are always hard to find. And I think it says a little something. I love Clint Irwin. His story is really good and special. About almost the journeyman nature of goalkeeping in the league,
mm-hmm.
where you could be the best team in the league and sort of, you know, be unsure about your goalkeeping.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a great question. I think it's also a great problem to have in some ways, but Toronto is not the only team in MLS that has had success mixing it up at the back this season. And yes, goalkeepers are hard to come by in any league, but we've seen a number of times where MLS teams have had to rely on their backup for a variety of reasons, and they've really stepped up to the challenge. So, I have no idea how that shakes out for them in the playoffs, but I think, you know, yes, Irwin has made some crucial mistakes and so has Bono, and how it plays out, I don't really know, but they're certainly not the only club that has two very, very strong goalkeepers as options. And again, their success all season long has been about depth, and when you know you've got depth in the goalkeeper position, even better.
Giovinco is nowhere near the top of the goals level, which I think says something about the spreading of offense throughout the team, mm-hmm. with 15. Nemanja Nikolic is at 21 with Valeri and David Villa behind. I think that Gio was unfairly passed over for MVP last year. I don't think he really has a shout at it this year.
No. And a lot of that, too, is unfortunately just due through injury. But I don't think he's had a bad season for the times that he's been fit. I think, if anything, the dip we're seeing in Giovinco or his status in MLS is just the fact that the rest of the team has spread those goals out a bit more and really risen to the occasion, which it doesn't seem to faze Giovinco. He seems very positive about everything. He seems positive about the season, and he seems to really be clicked into helping his team out when and if he can, but which is also really positive to see from your star player.
Mm-hmm. The Lynx, because everybody is talking about the record,
yeah.
the team that's already clinched the Supporters' Shield, the Lynx between the current Toronto side and the 1998 LA Galaxy team are quite significant, with Greg Vanney, who played as a defender on that team, as the manager, and also having Dan Kalichman and Robin, I can't remember his surname off the top of my head. I had this up here. With two assistant coaches that also played as defenders on that 1998 team.
Mm-hmm.
We had some audio from Canadian manager Octavio Zambrano, who had been the manager of that side,
mm-hmm.
Earlier in the year, but also in the interview that we did not play, was him talking a little bit about those former players of his and the connections between the two sides. Would you like to listen to that now?
Absolutely. And then there's a bit as well where he does sort of talk about Toronto as well. So he actually does some of the comparison, which is kind of nice.
All right. Well, let's go now to Octavio Zambrano.
Okay.
Along similar lines, you know, you have a couple of your former players up in Toronto. How helpful is that to have guys that you know that well be a part of that?
Yes, it is. It is good. I mean, I think the world of them. I mean, Danny Kalichman was my captain, and he was a stand-up man in every single aspect of the game, on the field, off the field. He was really, truly a mentor. He was a mentor to Greg, to Greg. And Greg would probably be the first one to tell you. Dan, he came into with this great experience, having played in Japan, and he was you could tell the way he played, the way he acted. You know, talk about, you know, players emulating others. I can tell you quite a few players that played for that LA Galaxy team talking about that particular team, gain a lot from just watching Dan perform. And the same could be said for Robin, because Robin was also part of that group. But you know, it's good. It's good that they are you know, kind of continuing into a career that is very rewarding, and I'm glad to see that they are doing well.
Speaking of those LA teams, you know, this Toronto team is being compared and it's being asked if they're the best team ever in MLS. Mm-hmm. How do you see that sort of behavior?
Well, the only thing I can say is that if that 98 team would be playing right now, it would be a very difficult team to beat. Very difficult team to beat. And, so for those who say that, you know, that was a different time and that this is, no. That was a tough team to beat and a good team on the field. And those three guys, Greg, Dan, and Robin, were a big part of that. So I will always be proud of that group, and they are too. But you know, records are meant to be broken. And I was joking with Jonathan Osorio about, you know, whether they're gonna break the record. And then I said, yeah, you may break one record, but I don't think you're gonna break them all. but it's all in good spirits. You know, it's great actually to see that's just something else that people are talking about in soccer. I mean, this is awesome.
Than LA had at that time. What do you think about that question? And it's sort of about sort of the connection of those two teams and what we heard from Zambrano.
I think it's great. You know, I think sometimes mistakenly, I'm going to avoid answering the question and say something else.
Ah!
Is that I think sometimes we mistakenly focus on these sort of like apparent coincidences in football rather than focusing on the fact that I think that there's intention there. I mean, the fact that Vanny has surrounded himself with these people and the fact that Toronto is so successful, I don't think is a fluke. I don't think their ultimate project is to break every single record. I think if you asked Vanny right now, he'd be rightly saying, like, we're going to be focused on winning our last two games so that we've got a positive run of results heading into the playoffs. That being said, they certainly know about it and know that it's a thing that they would love to do and would love to break. Is it the best MLS side ever? I think maybe the next two games are the thing that will tell us that. The Montreal game, they really should win. Montreal's a little bit of a wounded animal now, but we know about the rivalry between the two teams. Montreal is not going to make it easy for them. And I think the real test, if they beat Atlanta, and I would say this regardless of where the Atlanta game was, if they beat Atlanta, then they are definitely, they deserve that top honor of best MLS side ever. Not because of the fact that Atlanta is so amazing and had this storybook expansion season, but because Atlanta is one of those teams that many teams across the league have really struggled with this season. And just, of course, it's ultimately about the final number of points. Toronto has done so much so right to earn all the praise that they've gotten this year, but to me, to really really prove it, I think they need to go in and put Atlanta in their place and win that game away. And that is where Toronto has struggled a little bit, is their away games.
Mm-hmm.
And we know lots of teams, except for Minnesota, have struggled in Atlanta in that massive cavernous stadium of theirs. So I don't know. I'm curious to know what you think, but I'm not willing to put my money down and say this is the best MLS side ever. But if they win that distinction, I'm not going to be very surprised by it either.
I think those two long unbeaten runs are really something.
Yeah.
And hard to, as if you're talking about accomplishments during a year, to have not just 8 but also 11.
Mm-hmm.
And to do both of those in the same year is quite something. They have a very low goals against compared to just Kansas City.
Yeah.
Who themselves have a historically low goals against. This year, the goals for is not going to break LA Galaxy's record.
No.
As Zambrano predicted. But it's also quite 71 is crazy.
Yeah.
In terms of what's been put together as in terms of regular season accomplishments, I think it's huge.
And in the right, current climate of MLS as well, and the quality of the other teams, and that's a thing that can't be overlooked, is the sheer quality of other teams and the competitiveness of both conferences right now. Yeah.
They've really had accomplishments. They've had the players. They've the salary in the team has been put together.
Yeah.
I think this is something people talk about when they talk about how good Toronto is now, is that you do have to look at the means that were put to them in order to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But they had bought other good players before and not won, and they had, you know, not won before with this team. So I think that's really you have to look at they have built their team into a team. They didn't just go out and buy this team.
Yeah.
As much as it is a team that has means behind it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's a little unfair to just say they bought this team. I mean, yes, of course, in some ways they did, but I think they've also shown that's what it takes to build a really competitive international soccer side is resources. And that's not just about big money signings, but that's resources all around the club, which they've been investing in. And as much as we talk about the salary list, let's not forget it's not cheap to run an academy system as well. And they've put the pieces in now that over the next 5-10 years, if those academy products start to produce, they've put in a really great structure for them to come in and succeed in, which means that ultimately you need to spend, ideally, I think, less and less on these massive signings to help your club out, that you can augment them with homegrown players. I don't know if that's their ultimate plan, but I assume considering the resources they've invested in their academy, that must be at least part of the picture going forward.
It's interesting given that you have, given that at the end of the last regular season, you would not have said, oh yeah, this team's going to go to MLS Cup and then break the record for most points next year. The fact that there are so many factors converging in terms of the coaching staff and the coaching staff coming together as being ex-players, to have Zambrano as the national coach and just be sort of watching from a distance,
yeah,
could have been anywhere else in the world,
mm-hmm.
But just happens to be the Canadian manager at this point in time.
Yeah.
To look a little bit about how that came together, back to go and look at a little league history. It was also a year that was defined by its previous year, with the previous coach had gone 1-7 to start the season in 1997, which is when our man Zambrano was given the case. A lot of players, including Vanny, were there beforehand. The goalkeeper Kevin Hartman was also there there that year, and made it kind of as far as I believe the first round of the playoffs before losing to the Dallas Burn. They laid down a foundation with 14 wins and 44 points, which was not anywhere near sort of the top of what it could have been, with I think the top team was DC United with 55 points that season. And then you get into the 1998 year, they do break the record for goals. They have 24 wins, which Toronto is short of, with 17. The next year, modern football be damned, Zambrano is the 98 team, as I've said before, is great and impressive as their year was, they lost, beating Dallas Burn in the next in the first round in a rematch of those two teams, and then losing to the Chicago Fire also on a shootout. So they lost on a shootout both times. Was a rough situation, and then all it took after, I guess it was four seasons only at that point in time, but all it took after such an amazing year was to go 2-3 to start the season. There were such high expectations, and that's when Siggy Schmidt got his call in to get his first Galaxy run. So it was a team that sort of was able to recoup on a year where they started slow and got bright by having a blistering run the whole time through, but couldn't break through in the playoffs. And the next, it wasn't until the next year in 99 that they made the final when they were unsuccessful. So that must have been an interesting period. I think the early history of the MLS is always fascinating to me in general, but that squad specifically was able, like Toronto, to sort of peak and build on previous results.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, but I mean, hey, it's MLS, so you never know. They could crash and burn in the first round, and then we'll all be really scratching our heads, and we'll be watching Columbus in the final or some crazy scenario. Isn't it crazy that you can have a team like Toronto be so dominant and yet think really it could come down to these last two games and their form going into the playoffs? And it is, I think it's unlikely, but it's totally within reason that they actually do get knocked out, and we end up having to scramble everything and start talking about teams that we haven't talked about much this season.
I think that it is so funny to me. It's such something that's so characteristic of MLS that team matchups are so specific and indelible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it doesn't matter how good New York City is, Toronto has their number.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how good Toronto is, often but not always, as we saw in the Canadian Championship, Montreal is going to give them a hard game, yeah, no matter where Montreal is in the standings. So I think it's always the role of matchups in the league is really fascinating to me, because they often don't have anything to do with the team's standings.
No, and as Philadelphia, as DC, as Colorado have shown in recent games, even when there's really nothing in it, they can still be a real pain in the ass and really take chunks out of other teams and hurt them down the stretch. I don't think we can say too much more until we see some more games, because after all of this being said and done, we're going to have a huge number of games next weekend that could very much change the playoff picture, especially in the West.
Mm. To give a to tell one more piece of a story that could potentially be the same case again. I think they went. Where was the stat I was looking at? They scored two goals or more a game in, I think, 10 of their last. 10 of their last something. Where was it? I missed it. I lost it, but they lost their last game. The 24th win was the last game against Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
1-0. That was also the Western Conference final.
Mm.
So we're looking at them going up against Atlanta in the last game, which could also, I think is the team with the hottest, I think, in the best form right now,
yeah,
in terms of momentum around the team, if not necessarily on the club itself. And I could see that it was a two goal margin of victory in 14 of its last 19 wins.
Yeah. I'm predicting a 5-goal game against Atlanta. Just, I don't know who, I don't know how those 5 goals are going to be divided amongst the teams, but I feel like that's not going to be a 1-0 win for either team.
Somebody's getting a fine.
Somebody's getting fined.
This is my prediction is that probably Atlanta for some sort of fan chicanery. They're gonna pull a Toronto Blue Jays and have somebody throw a beer can or whatever.
Yeah. Section 203 will be sent off.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If we could see a fan get sent off, if that can happen,
it's MLS, I think that baby. Anything can happen. All right, Andrew, where can we find you online?
You can find me at Team Bates on Twitter, www.team-bates.com. You could give a look at Howler Magazine's fall issue, whatahowler.com. Where can we find you online?
I am tweeting ever so intermittently at ThatSoMLS, and that's basically it. I'm just having my little echo chamber conversation about Davies falling off a cliff after the Gold Cup, so you can come join in on that if you want. Until next time, Andrew.
Yes.
Don't change your formation at the last second.
Sounds good. See you next week, folks.
Okay.